Well, thank you so much, choir. That was beautiful. I love that hymn. Thank you so much, Bruce, for leading us in a very touching tribute to the Wallaces. Thank you, Jennifer, for your prayers and leadership. And thank you, everybody, for being here today. You know, we've been in the midst of a campaign here at Birmingham. We started it 3 weeks ago. And I think it's been a lot of fun, really. I've talked to a lot of different people who've been very engaged by it and have enjoyed the experience. But it hasn't been your average, ordinary kind of campaign, right? It's not been a political campaign. I mean, John Wolfe is not running for some office that I know about. It has not been a financial campaign. It's been what we have called a campaign for kindness in this little part of our world and kindness in the world in general. And so, since it's the end of the campaign, I thought it might be a good idea to spend just a minute reviewing where we've been. And so, the first week of the campaign, we said, be kind to yourself. And it was kind of built around the statement that Jesus gave us when he said, love your neighbor as you love who? Yourself. And quite frankly, there's some people that love themselves in ways that I'm not sure I would want them loving me. But we challenged you to be kind to yourself. Then the next week, we talked about being kind to your family. And that was kind of interesting. That can be touchy and sensitive, and it hit some people right between the eyes. But it was a wonderful time together that morning as we talked about being kind to our family. Then last week, we looked at being kind to our coworkers. And that can be in almost any kind of environment where we're working with people. But we challenge you to be kind to your coworkers. And alongside of this, Jennifer's done a great job every Sunday of offering us in the bulletin different ways that we can be kind to ourselves, to our families, and to our coworkers. And there's no difference today. We have listed in there some things that you can do to be kind to your community. And so we're going to talk about a couple of ways that you can be kind to your community even today. But first of all, I want to talk about a definition for community. Community can be defined in many, many different kinds of ways. And I looked at this. I saw like technical definitions. I saw research definitions. I saw just kind of generic definitions. And I really liked this definition that I found from a guy called Fabian Fortmuller. How about that for a name? He said, a community is a group of people who care about each other and feel that they belong together. And I loved that because obviously you want a community to be a place where people care about one another. And you also want it to be a place where you feel a sense of belonging and shared identity, and you have a sense of ownership over what's happening with that community. And so today, I'm calling you to be kind to your community. And you can do that in a couple of ways. First of all, you can do that, and we have done that, by celebrating Susan and Jarrett Wallace and their family and the years of ministry that they've spent here at Birmingham. And so I would encourage you following the service. I think we still have a lot more food over there, and I think that they're going to be across the way to greet folks after the service. I hope that you'll take advantage of that. And then secondly, really in honor of Susan and her ministry, we're inviting you to pack a blessing bag and put it in your car so that when you encounter a person who is in need, you will have a response that will be kind and helpful. So that's what we're asking you to do today. But let me share a couple of stories with you. I guess the year was 1987, and I had graduated from college at Central College in Pella, Iowa. I had purchased a brand new car, a Nissan Sentra. I think it was like $9,800. You remember those days? And I had bought also a brand new computer for the purpose of traveling with my parents. They were helping me out as I moved from Newton, Iowa to Boston University School of Theology. And I'll tell you, that was quite a journey. It was a 26-hour drive, I think. Pennsylvania is very slow. 26-hour drive. Over about two or three different days. And it really went pretty well. And we pulled in to the area where Boston is located. And we we got off of the highway and we hit Starro Drive, and we took Starro Drive around to Commonwealth Avenue, and we got off at Commonwealth Avenue, and we drove up along the street where we were staying in a hotel on Commonwealth Avenue, and we parked our cars, and we got out of the cars, and out of nowhere, instantly, when my parents got out of their car, a homeless man who was there on the side of the road, he ran at them. I mean, he didn't just walk up to them. He ran at them, and I wish you could have seen the look on my mother's face. I mean, let's face it, it was kind of country come to town. I mean, from Newton, Iowa to Boston, Massachusetts. I mean, seriously? And he was, you know, disheveled looking and tattered clothing, and his hair was wild, and I had never seen this in my life before, but he was foaming at the mouth. And I know exactly what was going through my parents' minds at that moment. We're getting back in our cars and we're going back to Iowa. I know that that's what they were thinking. And so I tried to calm them down, and I didn't have the right things to say. I think I said something like, you know, they're usually not this extreme, which was a terrible thing to say, but it was just in the moment. And I handed the guy a $20 bill and he went on his way. But I'll tell you, it was really a moment for my family. It was really an incredibly uncomfortable, awkward moment. That's the first story. Now, the second story is one of those stories that you would hear at the, and I did hear this, I think, at the end of NBC Nightly News, and with Lester Holt, and it was one of those inspirational stories. They have all of these kind of negative stories. Until the very end, you get this inspirational story, and it was the story of a British woman who was 18 years old, and her name was Paige Hunter, and she was getting attention from the news media because of how she had responded to a trend that was happening in her community. And here's what was happening in her community. The folks that were struggling with depression and maybe other forms of mental illness, they were finding their way to a bridge. I think it was called the Wearmouth Bridge. And they were there at that bridge, sitting and thinking and pondering taking their life, which many of them did. And Paige just happened to notice over time that there are all of these suicides at the Wearmouth Bridge. And so she decided to do something about it. She went to the Wearmouth Bridge and she posted about 40 laminated notes that were placed in strategic locations on that bridge in the hopes that she could sway people who were struggling with mental illness. And you hear that and you think, well, that's, you know, like what could 40 post-it notes do for people that were struggling in that manner? Well, you'd be surprised, because after the sixth person showed up in the emergency room at the local hospital saying, I was at the Wearmouth Bridge and I saw these notes and it changed my decision, the media jumped in. And it went all the way from over there in England to the NBC Nightly News. Wow. She was being kind to her community. And it made a difference for six different people. Okay, so why am I telling you these stories of driving to Boston and encountering homeless people and dealing with people sitting on a bridge contemplating taking their lives? Why am I telling you this story? Well, I'm telling you this story because it reminds us that we are living in a broken world made up of broken communities and broken people. That we're living in a world that is struggling with brokenness at every possible level. They're struggling with brokenness in their homes. They're struggling with brokenness at their schools. They're struggling with brokenness at their businesses. And at the whole community level, we are struggling with brokenness. And so we see it in many different kinds of faces. We see it in the faces of racism. We see it in the faces of ageism and sexism and all the isms. We see this in a homeless person who's existing in one of the most well-resourced communities probably in the world, Boston, Massachusetts, and he's foaming at the mouth. We see this in a community in England where people have no help, no assistance, so they go to a bridge to end it all. And then I didn't mention this one. You know, we drive around our community and we look at it and we assume everything is peachy keen and fine and happy and hunky-dory because look at the houses. I mean, seriously, look at the land, look at the environment, look at the kind of schools that we have. And yet when we drive home that night and we turn on the evening news, what do we hear? Another overdose. It's the heroin triangle. We are living in a broken world made up of broken communities and broken people. And so the question is, what does the Bible say about this? How does Jesus address this? Well, I would say that Jesus, the beautiful news is that Jesus is well acquainted with brokenness. He himself in his life at the end of the day when he was hanging on the cross, he was broken for us. He was constantly building his ministry, not around people who were healthy and well, but he was building his entire ministry. Think about this. His whole legacy, everything that he was about was built around broken people in broken communities living out the broken world. Those are the kind of people that Jesus gravitated to. And it's really interesting. You can look on virtually any page of the Gospels, and I think you can see this, but I think we see this to be especially true in the scripture that we call the Beatitudes, which we kind of heard this morning. In the Beatitudes. And so you have two different versions of the Beatitudes in the Gospels. You have Luke's version of the Beatitudes, and then you have Matthew's version of the Beatitudes. And they're very different if you read them. And there's many different theories from different theologians and biblical scholars about why we have these two different versions of the Beatitudes. But I really have to say I love them both. I love that Luke's version of the Beatitudes that he starts out standing, that Jesus in Luke starts out standing on a level place. It's interesting. That's the verbiage used, that Jesus went and stood on a level place, and then he delivered this amazing message that we call the Beatitudes. If you look in the Gospel of Matthew, it's a completely different vision of this. In the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus is really like a Moses-type figure, and he's up high and lifted up, and he's up on this mountain, and whereas Luke is very eminent and kind of common ground and hanging out with the common people, in Matthew, Jesus is high and lifted up, and he's transcendent, and he's bigger than life. And from there, he delivers the Beatitudes. And so they're very different. In Luke, Jesus identifies with all the poor people, with the community of the poor. And so he says, "Blessed are the poor." But then you go over to Matthew, and you see a more exalted, kind of more lofty version. Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Then you look in Luke's gospel, and you see Luke saying, "Blessed are you who weep now." And then it says, "For you will laugh," which is kind of interesting. In Matthew, it's a much more fuller version of the experience of weeping and sorrow. He says, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." And so it's almost as though in these two Gospels, we're hearing that Jesus identifies you with you in the moment of conflict, in the moment of dissatisfaction, of challenge, that there's no doubt in Luke's gospel that Jesus is on a level ground with you. He's imminent. He's present with you in that moment. But Matthew also reminds us that in that very moment, he's not only imminent, he is transcendent. He's bigger than life. He's greater than any challenge we could ever face. And so he's not only sitting there with us in our moment of struggle, he's got a solution that can change everything for us. And we don't really talk about that kind of thing anymore. We sort of say, well, yeah, he does. Jesus is the answer. That's right, true. But we kind of live in the other place. But both are true. Jesus is eminent and transcendent to the conflicts and the challenges that we face. And so today, I thought it might be interesting to talk about brokenness in our lives, in our communities, in our world, from the perspective of one of the most beautiful Beatitudes that Jesus delivered. And it's interesting, he didn't offer it in Luke. We don't see it in Luke. We only see it in Matthew's gospel. I think it may be the case that we see it just in Matthew's gospel because in some ways it reflects Luke. In other ways, it reflects only Matthew. In some ways, he's with us in the midst of our challenge. In other ways, he's way beyond it. But the scripture that I'm referring to, the beatitude that I'm referring to, is Matthew chapter 5, verse 9. So let's say this together. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the children of God. So let's just stop right there. Let's say that again. Blessed are what? The peacemakers. For they will be called what? The children of God. And I love that. I love the idea that peacemakers are the children of God. That says that peacemakers, it's like they reflect the DNA of God, that they are the offspring of God, that they are the children, that they are the ones born of God. So when you're talking about a peacemaker, you're talking about someone who looks like God. I love that. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be the children, the likeness, the presence, the DNA, the biological identity, the anatomy of God. I love that. I love also that when you look at kind of the idea behind blessed are the peacemakers, one of the places that you go is to the Old Testament, and one of the great words for peace in the Old Testament, you probably know that is what? It's shalom. Say that to your neighbor. Shalom. Don't you love how that rolls off your tongue? Shalom. That's the word for peace in the Old Testament, and it kind of has two different meanings. On one hand, it's kind of like saying, when you say shalom, you're kind of saying, listen, I hope that there's no bad or challenging things in your life. I'm really hoping that anything challenging or difficult is minimized and goes away. Shalom. But so often we stop there. It's like, I hope conflict leaves. So often we stop there. It's also saying something else. It's also saying, I not only hope that all these bad things go out of your life, I'm also hoping that you have so many good things, abundantly good things, that God gives you the most incredible things, that you do know a group, a community that cares for you, that you do know a place where you belong, and it is your place, and you have shared identity. So when we say shalom, we're not only saying, I hope the conflict goes away, we're also saying, and I hope God brings you the highest possible good. So Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the people that bring shalom. Blessed are the ones that help people find a sense of belonging. Blessed are the ones who care for other people. For this is the biology, the anatomy, the DNA of God. These are the children of God. And so, it's interesting because in the Gospels, this would have been like shocking, I guess. Because what people followed by was the old law and the old rules. And the old rules said, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, baby. You take something from me, I'm taking something from you. You do something to me, I am doing something back to you. And when Jesus offered really the whole Beatitudes, he was saying, that is over. That has got to conclude. That is not how we are called to live. We are called to live at a higher level. We are called to live at the level of a peacemaker. Because blessed are the peacemakers. They are the children of God. And so the question becomes, and I struggled with this all week long, the question becomes, what does a peacemaker do? And how do we form communities of kindness around peacemaking? So what does a peacemaker do? And I came up with this thing that I think is a wonderful United Methodist understanding of a peacemaker. Here is what a peacemaker does. A peacemaker helps other people make peace with God and peace with themselves and peace with others. That's what a peacemaker does. I love that. A peacemaker helps, enables other people to make peace with God. And I think this is really even the hardest one. Peace with themselves and peace with others. That's what a peacemaker does. Now the question is, how do they do that? And I struggle with this. And there's got to be 1,000 or 10,000 different self-help books that lay out for you, and you can buy them in your store or online from Amazon, and will lay out for you a map. Like, it will map out a peacemaking pathway for you and your family, or you and your business, or you and your school, or you and your community group. You can map it out. You can go with that book. And basically, as I read several of these different kinds of ideas, I found that there was two or three different things that kind of always happen with peacemaking. Number one, it seems like there is almost always this kind of meeting where there is open, honest discussion and truth-telling and affirmation, and it's always in the context of love. And there's the idea that everybody kind of comes together around the table. They're open, they're honest, they share their feelings, their thoughts, their story on this particular conflict, and they get it out on the table, and they feel heard, and they feel understood. And then that's kind of the first step. Then the second step is, you know, there's got to be some apology. There's got to be someone saying, I'm sorry, I'm owning my part in this, I didn't mean to do that, or I did mean to do that, whatever it may be. But there's got to be some kind of apology that's thrown out there. And then this is where you have to remember the six most important words in the world. Do you know what the six most important words are? Do you know? Ha! So you need to know this. You do. The six most important words in the world. As I tell every couple that I meet with before their marriage, I tell them this, and here they are. The first three are, I am sorry, right? Hello, let's practice that together, because those are three of the six most important words. Let's say it, I am sorry, and then the next one is, you are forgiven. Now, somebody in the early service said, well, if it's my wife, I have to say you are right. But that's not, maybe it is for you. But the six most important words, let's say them together, I am sorry and you are forgiven. And that has to happen. That has to happen to go on. And then there's, in these books, this idea that there is a symbol kind of all of this. There's a covenant. There's a contract. I mean, at the government level, they call them peace treaties, right? But there's got to be some kind of symbol of this peacemaking effort and of this finding peace with God, with myself, and with my neighbor. And it doesn't happen in our world very often. But when it does, it's spectacular. And several nights ago, the Men's Grill hosted a woman whose name is Sarah. She's got a long name. Sarah Buchanan Sasson. And she was fantastic. And she works with a ministry in a country called Rwanda. You've heard of Rwanda. She works with a ministry in Rwanda that is called Kula. And it's a coffee ministry. Now, it's much more than just a coffee ministry. It's a coffee ministry, but it also is a ministry that helps Rwandan people actually build businesses where they can then overcome their poverty. So it's interesting. One of the things that the Kula Ministry says is that poverty in Rwanda will not be ended by charity, which is quite shocking, really. That's quite shocking. But it will be ended through businesses that Rwandan people build and hold. And it was just a really, for those of the guys that were there, it was just a wonderful message that she brought from the Kula Ministry. But in the context of that, she shared a few other stories. And you may remember, Rwanda really kind of hit the airwaves in 1994 when there was an incredible genocide that was happening between two ethnic groups in Rwanda. And one group was trying to cleanse the country of the other group. So the Hutus were trying to cleanse Rwanda of the Tutsis. And it was brutal. It was terrible. There was not a lot of gunfire, but instead, these Hutus were going house to house with machetes and killing people just right on the spot, whole families being, you know, cut down with machetes, and it was just brutal. And in fact, there was a movie that came out called The Hotel Rwanda, which kind of tells the whole story, and it's a very, I would recommend it in a heartbeat. It will transform you if you watch it, but it is brutal. And so in the aftermath, years later, or a few years later, after all of this had concluded, there was the question, what are we going to do with all of these Hutus who are guilty of these war crimes? And there simply wasn't enough space in jails in Rwanda to house all of them. And so in response to that, some years later, the government offered a peacemaking solution. And it's amazing. It was called Gachacha. It empowered local communities to hold kind of like tribunals where guilty parties could admit their guilt and families could respond. And you know what a gachacha is? It's a place where people make peace with God, peace with themselves, and peace with other people. So here's what would happen at a gachacha. Someone would stand up, and I guess they'd move to a podium, and the whole community was before them, and they would confess their crimes, their participation in the genocide. And I'm imagining that was pretty brutal to hear. But they would confess their crimes and stand there kind of wide open to the community and make that confession. And then, and maybe it was a family member, maybe it was a child that had grown up, maybe it was an extended family member of someone that was actually brutally killed by this person making the confession, that person would stand up and they would have in their hands a basket. And in fact, it was a basket just like this one. Jeff White had this basket. It's from Rwanda. And that family, that person responding, would fill it with food. And they would walk up to that person and they would hand them the basket. And that person knew this was not just an offering of food. This was an offering of peace. Because blessed are the peacekeepers, peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. And it's an amazing thing. This was at the local level. This was not governors and leaders that were doing this. This was at the local level. It was with broken people living in a broken world and a broken community. And they made an offering of peace. And it changed everything. Now Rwanda is like the fifth cleanest country in the world. It's the third most beautiful country in the world. It has all of these statistics. It changed everything. That those one small acts of kindness to the community brought peace. So listen, be a peacemaker. Be kind to your community. Let's bow our heads for a moment of prayer. Heavenly Father, we do thank you for this higher call to be peacemakers, to be peacemakers at our homes, to be peacemakers in our schools, to be peacemakers in our churches, to be peacemakers in our community, to everywhere we go, reflect the identity, the DNA, the anatomy of God, which is that we would be peacemakers. And so, Lord, bless us as we leave Campaign Kindness and you lead us into places where we can be peacemakers. Pray these things in the name of Jesus Christ.